This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
My name's Richard Watts. I'm a writer and broadcaster from both Arts Hub and 3RRR. I would like to pay my respects to the elders of the Kulin Nation, past and present, and indeed to elders of all communities who may be with us today. We're here for a conversation with Robert Lepage, who I'm sure needs no introduction to everybody in the room. He is a theatre director, a playwright, an actor, a filmmaker, and more. His latest work, or current work, 887 is showing at the Melbourne Festival. Can I just get a quick show of hands for those who've already seen the production? A great many of you. Great. So we'll try to avoid spoilers for the rest of you. Robert,
yep.
There's a scene in the production where you say that theatre for you began as shadow play in a bedroom as a child. I'm wondering, is that the truth, or was that poetic license? And
well, actually, my show is performed in a style or written in a style which is autofiction. So that means everything is true, but everything's a bit untrue. yes, of course. The first theatre experience I remember was playing around in the bunk bed with my sisters or my neighbours who also had bunk beds, and we would play with sheets, and we had understood that flashlights or candles, well, candles were more dangerous, but but we did use candles at times. So it was our first theatrical experiences, and later on it became something else, and we started to put makeup and costumes on and things like that. But I kind of preferred the shadow play period of my theatrical discovery because it was less exposing. You know, you're hiding. People don't really see you. They only see a shape and or different shapes. So that was my favorite part of learning or exploring theater. But I was quite young. I was 5 or 6 years old in those days. And we had this wonderful show. I'm sure you had the equivalent here in Australia, called Mr. Dress-Up. It was on TV. It was this odd, celibate, mature man who would invite children into his home. And he would show them how to do, dolls with yarn, I don't know, with fabric or whatever, and how to play farm and how to play this and that. And of course, he would do these shadow things. So I guess it's from Mr. Dress Up was my mentor.
One of the things that fascinates me about that kind of shadow play is, yes, its simplicity, but also because it taps so directly into the power of the imagination. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if that's perhaps also one of the reasons why it fascinated you and is clearly still continuing to echo in your work today.
Well, it's also because it's not only the origins of theatre, I think, it's also the origins of cinema. And today, we've kind of divided these two storytelling techniques as if they're very radically different vocabularies and as if these two things are so strange, you know, that they can't really live together on the same, or they can't collaborate to tell the same story. So my theater is very image-based, so film and video and shadow play and all of that is welcomed. And so my view of theater is very, very permissive in that sense. So that's why shadow play for me is not just a theatrical thing, it's also a cinematic thing, so.
That notion of the image-based work that you create, to what degree was that a response to being bilingual and living in a bilingual country like Canada, where there are, as the production documents, tensions between the French-speaking and the English-speaking? Was the making images a way to overcome the boundaries of language?
Well, not at the time, but for sure with time, the theatre companies or dance companies or circus companies of Canada or of Quebec that managed to have an international career were much more image-based than text-based. And I was part of that kind of movement at one time. And the theatre that was more about literature and poetry, written poetry and the spoken word, kind of stayed home. So there was this kind of movement in the 80s where we said, well, yeah, it's important, we're French Canadians, our first language, our native tongue, our mother tongue is French, but we're interested in what other people around the world are what they think of who we are, and we're trying to open it to a more universal style of acting and directing and writing. So so we kind of shied away, and what I would, my early shows would be less verbal, very, very visual. But with time, we discovered that we could also use surtitles, and there are other ways of being understood, even if you... So then we started to be less shy of speaking French during our shows and our creations.
Now, one of the things that fascinated me about 8087, having seen it last night, is just how autobiographical it was. Mm-hmm. Now, often, not always in the arts, obviously, but often writers in particular, for example, will tell their most autobiographical work first, thinly disguised as fiction, for example. Uh-huh. And in later life, as they become more confident and more imaginative with their chosen art form, they move away from autobiography mm-hmm. towards true fiction, to imaginative storytelling that is not based on their real lives. Now, you've always been present in your work to a degree, sometimes mm-hmm. As a version of yourself or a facet of yourself, sometimes more overtly. But nonetheless, it strikes me as interesting that you've waited until this point in your career mm-hmm. to tell a work that is so absolutely about you, yourself, your family, and your mm-hmm. childhood.
I mean, it's a strange thing, because I was tempted before to do that, but I always avoided doing that because I was thought it's very pretentious to, you know, to do this kind of thing. I mean, I hate this kind of show. You know, you go to a show and somebody thinks he's important enough or interesting enough to put his own life directly on stage, and you know, as if he was an example and, or a hero or a martyr or something like that. So I don't like that kind of theater or that kind of storytelling. So I've always kind of avoided doing it. Then I thought, well, maybe there's something in that. And it also stems from the idea of trying to get rid of theater in the early minutes of the show. Because I always felt when I do shows, one-man shows or collective shows, that theater is often an obstacle to invite people on stage. You start your show and people are kind of going, wait a minute, I have to adapt to this. Okay, they're wearing costumes. Oh, it's kind of, oh, they're speaking in a special kind of way and all that. And people, there's a thick wall, a thick fourth wall. And after a while, they eventually get it, and they let themselves go into the storytelling and into the experience. But and I wanted to kind of try something where there would not be that kind of fourth wall when we start, that it would, well, without giving punches, giving away punches, that you know, you start and you say, okay, relax, there will not be theater, you know. I'm just me, I'm going to talk about something direct. It's a conference, basically, and all that. So people kind of listen to it in a very different way, and they open up, their chakras open up, and you could really feel it. You know, that in the room, the people have a different way of sitting on their seats, listening to you and all that, because there's no idiot up there with a costume that goes, hi, I'm Titus Andronicus. And it's just a guy that comes in and says, hi, you know, it's a show about memory. And slowly you kind of, you know, there's a couple of hooks, and then you pull people into the realm of theater, and then they play the game and the rules with you. But so I wanted to try something, but in order to do that, it meant that I had to be myself. I had to be a non-character. So that was a bit of a trap, because it meant that suddenly I had to speak about myself in the first person and not sound pretentious. And So it's, you know, it was walking on a lot of thin ice, because there are parts where I might seem pretentious, but it's because I present myself like that. You know, it's part of the game. I pretend to be a pretentious person, but I'm not. but what I want to say is that you play on that self-criticism, and you go into all these kind of little games with the audience where they understand that you're not pretentious. You're doing this because it's part of the game, and it allows you to be more candid, you know, about your own experience and about who you are.
Was that notion of beginning the show in that way as yourself and then easing both the production and mm-hmm. the audience into a more theatrical affair, was that always the way you'd intended for the work to start, or is that a device that you've come to over time? Because your mm-hmm. shows often evolve throughout their life, starting out at 3 mm-hmm. hours and extending to 9, for example, by the end of a season.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's the thing, is that I have the impression that often we take the audience for granted, right? We do these theater things, and we come up and I have this concept, and I'm going to do that, and then you just throw it at people, and people are either not prepared or they have their own life going on, and they have their own preoccupations. And what I find difficult is often there's like at least 10 to 20 minutes that are lost at the beginning of a show, where, you know, the audience is really looking at you and they want to understand, but in their, you could see in their eyes that they're thinking, okay, did I inform the babysitter that my son is allergic to peanuts? Or do we have reservations to that restaurant? Did we add another? And they're bringing the city and the street with them into the room, and you feel the traffic, and you could feel where they've parked the car, or if it's a, and you're doing Titus Andronicus, you know, and so for me there's that thing that you go, wait a minute, why don't you take the time, you know, to settle in, and I'll settle in, and all that, and then are we ready? Okay, let's go. But for that, you need to feel your audience. You need to feed the audience. It doesn't mean that you have to treat them like kids or like babies and all that. It's a question of finding the proper energy so that the experience will be about communion. You know, so.
I've seen it done a lot with stand-up comedy. The comedian who will spend the first 10 or 15 minutes of the show, A, waiting for latecomers to arrive, and they're essentially in a holding pattern, so they're doing that interaction with the front row of the audience, where are you from, cracking a few jokes. But I've not seen it done in theatre before, so it was intriguing. Now, to quote Oscar Wilde, "Man is least himself when he talks in his own person. Give him a mask and he will tell you the truth." Mm-hmm. Now, you once said in an interview, and I think it was with The Guardian, theatre is a masquerade party where everything is camouflaged. Has theatre in your past allowed you to camouflage or conceal something, perhaps yourself, your sexuality, or have you always been hiding in plain sight?
Well, I think that I've always been, of course, afraid of exposing myself 100%. You know, there's a lot of stuff I don't want to talk about. And today I'm more kind of relaxed about, but there's things about my youth that are much more important than what people see on stage these days that I just don't talk about, because it's not a therapy. It's not therapy art for me. It's just I'm trying to tell a story, and I will edit out whatever. So it's not dishonesty and it's not shyness. It's just these things don't belong in this story. But it's strange, because when I was in growing up in Quebec, in high school, you had to there was this compulsory art class. You had to do arts. You learn how to draw and paint or whatever. And if you didn't like it, then you would switch to music. And if that didn't do it for you, then you would switch to theater. So that's pretty much what I did through the years, and I ended up doing theater because it was the last art class you could take. And what I liked about it, compared to the other arts, is that you could hide behind the group. I was a very, very, I'm still a very shy person, but I was much, much shyer and had issues when I was young. And it was less exposing than sitting there with a classical guitar and trying to do, you know, or drawing and expressing yourself in a sculpture or something. It was like too much of a personal expression. But theater seemed to always be like a gang thing. Anyways, it was like 36 students in a class, and there was no way you would do a solo show. You know, you would always end up doing a very small part. And if the show sucked, it was because of the teacher or because of the director. It wasn't because of you. You know, you were just a student. So it was a great art form for me, for a very shy person who. So I naively thought that that's what a theater career would be about. You know, me hanging out with the gang and being protected, having a buffer, you know, of people who. And eventually, I don't know. It's a paradox. But we all have this. Suicidal instinct within us as artists, but you know, slowly you start doing solo shows, and it's clearly about you, you know, and you go, what am I doing? And so at first you do wear masks and costumes, and you change your name, and you even change your nationality or the culture of your character to really disguise yourself, and eventually you know, the layers come off, and you end up being quite naked on stage, like in 887 is like that. And also, coincidentally, this year I played in Quills, a play by Doug Wright, where I played the Marquis de Sade, and where you end up completely naked for 2/3 of the show, which I never thought I'd do in my life. So it's a year of striptease. it's you know, taking things off.
If there's any journalist in the room, I think that's your headline. Now, 887 is nominally a solo work, albeit one presented with some very important backstage assistance.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to talk for a moment about working with actors, which you've done as a director with sometimes very large casts, sometimes relatively small casts. When you work with actors, do you want them to own the text, to almost express the text as if they have created it, rather than you using them as puppets to say your words?
Well, it depends what we call a director. A director kind of sounds like it's somebody who directs you and says, we are going here and this is what you should do and all that. When in fact, I'm not much of a director. If that's a director, I'm not much of a director. I'm somebody who has a vision for, in general, for the piece, and an actor. It's also a very different situation if it's a written script or if it's a creation. In the case of a creation, it's just a series of improvs, and eventually the actor finds his own character and writes his own text. And of course, I will guide him on some things, but I will try to be receptive to his creativity and to what he's created, and try to see how that fits in the general project. So it's a very, very different process. When it's directing a written script, then of course I want to work with actors that are extremely creative, who have their own view on things, and I will respect their vision of it first. And if it doesn't work, then I'll barge in and I'll try to help them bring the project to fruition. But I don't impose a vision. I have a general vision of what the piece should be, but I don't necessarily tell them, I know what Juliet is, absolutely, and you do what I say. I don't work that way. I think it's not I'm not a control freak, and I don't like working with actors who cannot perform or cannot act if they're not whipped and hit. And I dare say that because I was in a context once in Germany where actors wanted us to do Scheiße Kopf, and it was no way I could do that. So it was a horrible experience. It was at the National Theater of Bavaria in Munich, and it's an amazing group of actors, and I'm generalizing because some of them weren't like that, but most of them, you know, would not. They were accustomed to be screamed at, shouted at, and hit in certain circumstances, and I've witnessed this. So I said, well, I'm sorry, but I don't hit people, and I don't shout at people, and I just kind of discuss and negotiate and guide people. I don't try to impose my vision in a drastic and dominant fashion. You know,
I've heard it said that in the rehearsal room, when you are developing a new work, and I mean by which I mean a new work, not necessarily based on an existing text, that you really encourage a sense of play within the room.
Yeah.
That, and that to a degree, perhaps the professional theatre industry has lost that sense of playfulness that it once had.
Yeah, people are interested in acting. And I don't like acting. Not on the stage. I'm not. In the playfulness that I'm talking about, it's not just playfulness amongst actors. It's also between the audience and the actor and the player. And I think that's kind of been evacuated from the stages in the 20th century. I don't know for what reason. Maybe because of we're trying to emulate film, we're trying to emulate television. I don't know what it is, but. It's a question of deciding where you want the emotion of the experience to be. So we're being convinced when we're in theater schools and all that emotion has to be on stage. So I have the emotion and then you have the emotion and we're working on our emotion. But there's no emotion over there. It's just a bunch of spectators looking, oh my God, this is so much work. Oh, look, what a great actor. He was really suffering, you know. But people did not get anything. So my approach to this is, how can we be playful enough with the audience so that the emotion is there? And even if there's no emotion here, who cares, right? The emotion has to be there. So it's a completely different approach and way of seeing things. And that's how it used to be. Right, and that was kind of evacuated because now we're just sitting in dark rooms looking at close-ups of Tom Cruise you know, pretending to be sad, and we're going, oh my God, this was probably was so difficult for him to do. And I don't have any no pleasure or emotion seeing that or doing that. So it has to be a collective, playful process. And we forget that, you know, we say a play. It's probably called a play for some reason. And in every culture, it's like that. A Schauspiel, you know, a play. There's the word Spiel, which means to play. In French, we call it the game, le jeu. Acting is called the game. So in every culture, there's the word playing. And now we're dealing with a bunch of actors, you know. So I think that there's a reflection to be had on how, why that is, and how theater kind of evolved into this kind of odd, encaged experience amongst actors, you know.
You've just reminded me of a conversation I had with a British performer, Jess Tom, who was out here for the festival, in a work backstage at Biscuitland. She has Tourette syndrome, and has made a show about what it's like to live with Tourette's. And she commented on the fact that she was made to feel uncomfortable at the theatre because she can't sit still and quiet and reverent in that kind of absorbed middle-class theatre way that we have paid for this experience, and it is wonderful. Mm-hmm. And she spoke about the fact that in Shakespeare's day people were raucous and yelling and alive in a way that theatrical audiences now aren't. Mm-hmm. Why do you think we've lost that sense of spirit and adventure in the audiences as well as mm-hmm. the industry of the theatre itself?
Well, I think also because, the person to blame or the thing to blame is this whole system that we've created, this subscribers system that we've created for practical, technical, and economical reasons. We want to guarantee people that they will not think. You know, you do a lot of thinking at your job, come here, and we guarantee you will not be thinking. You will be entertained. So there's this whole kind of thing of selling what we do, when in fact, it's people have jobs where they don't think, and they want to think, and they want to come to the theater because it's a mental workout, because it's a game, and they want to feel intelligent, and they want to... It's the same reason why people go to gyms, you know? They have a job on computer 9 to 5, and then they say, but I have all this energy in this body, so they need to go to a gym to... So it's the same kind of thing. That's what the living arts are for, us, is for people to come into a room and feel involved, playful. They don't want the actors or the whoever is telling the story to masticate the food for them. They want to taste it. So you have to give just enough so people say, oh, wait a minute, I'm connecting the dots here. Okay, oh, cool. And the greatest spectacle is always the spectacle of intelligence. So when people feel intelligent and they have the impression that they're looking at something that's intelligent, that's always the best spectacle. And I think that that's been kind of, once again, it's a victim of this system of saying, it won't be difficult for you to understand. You'll understand this one. You know, there's this kind of, and I think we have to get rid of this. And we've accustomed people that things will not be longer than 2 hours. So you'll have the time to catch the last bus or the last subway, and you'll be able to make... It's all organized around reservations in the restaurant and the pub, and it's absurd. So theater has to be, if it wants to survive, it has to be an event. And an event means that it's not necessarily taking place when you want it to take place. It's an event is something that kind of shakes your schedule, shakes your habits, and that's the only way theatre can survive, if it's eventful.
Now, your 1991 production, Needles and Opium, which I think you recently remounted at the mm-hmm. at the Barbican, explored a lot of things, addiction, including addiction to love. It also explored racial issues, and it explored the frictions of the class structure as well. Mm-hmm. And you've referenced class quite directly in 887 as well. I was wondering, to what degree has an awareness of class and class structure influenced you in your work?
Mm. Well... well, in 887, it's more obvious maybe than in other works, but there's this thing where people today, and certainly like in Quebec, for example, the whole separatist movement, I mean, it's an, they have good arguments, and it's an interesting thing to follow. But it's a very bourgeois, civilized 21st century artsy-fartsy intellect, well-educated people who talk about the future of Quebec as an independent country. But it comes from a class struggle from the 1950s and 60s, and nobody remembers that. Nobody remembers that before it was a Democratic Party and elected with all these intellectuals who got together. And it, before that, it was a class struggle. It was, you know, the people who spoke French were cheap labor, and the people who spoke English often were the bosses. And that's where the conflict started, and it came from a very, very essential thing. So I come from a working class family. And I'm not saying that everybody has to come from a working class family to understand these contexts, but nobody takes that into account anymore. So it was always very important in whatever the stories that I'm trying to tell to bring that back to a working class level where most people come from and where people can relate to, you know.
One of the other things that you talk about in the work is the fact that working class kids are increasingly locked out of working in the arts, working in theatre, mm-hmm. for example. Yeah. And that's something that's been remarked on by a number of performers in Australia as well as overseas in the UK. People like Paul McGann, mm-hmm. Judy Dench, Julie Waters, David Morrissey have all said that kids today don't have the opportunities that they had as working class kids in the 60s, 70s. What can we do to change that situation, to ensure that mm-hmm. the theatre is singing in all voices rather than just mm-hmm. in one voice with a middle-class accent?
Well, I don't know what exactly the solutions are, but what I know is that I come from a part of the world where everybody had access to that. It was free. Everybody equally could audition at the conservatory, and whether it's a music conservatory or a drama conservatory, and everybody had their chance. Now, the tuition is so expensive that, you know, there's like half of these people who don't audition anymore. So does that mean that excellence only comes from the upper class? No, excellence is hidden everywhere, in the lower classes, in the upper classes, in all the classes, in the middle classes. So if you want to, if a country wants to have a shop window of its knowledge, its industry, the way it thinks, its social values and all of that, and wants these people to represent their country in films or theater or whatever, that it has to come, the excellence has to be reaped from all the classes. It has to be, and now the system is made in a way where it's like the U.S. You know, it's unless you're subsidized by somebody who really believes in you and he will follow you and he will patronize you and he will. But it's so. My reaction to it, and certainly that's why I mentioned it in the show, is because in Quebec in general, not just arts, but in any field of study or any educational system, now you have to pay. You have to pay a lot of money, and more money. And there was a big movement 3 or 4 years ago where students, you know, decided to do a strike and marches and demonstrations. And you could really see the social malaise that accompanied that. And that was all crushed, and now that's all been silenced. I think that at least for a full year in Quebec, there was this consciousness of, you know, are we following the American system in our way of dealing with education and arts and culture in general?
What can culture do, what can theatre do specifically, to illuminate and challenge that social malaise you've just spoken about, but also the ecological crisis that the planet is facing, the political crisis? How mm-hmm. can art encourage change without being polemic?
Well, I think it's a question of, once again, I don't really have a clear answer to this, but I know that what I do travels a lot, okay? And we're a touring company. We perform 10 times more outside of the country than inside our country. So we're pretty much ambassadors of our country. And you have to constantly convince politicians, radio announcers, anybody who promotes or discusses or questions what it is that you do, that what you do is essential, and that you your presence in another country breaks deals for your country. There's engineers or investors who will invest in Australia if they see a circus company from Australia, and they love circus, and they look at this and go, oh, this is so Australian, whatever that is. So then they're interested in Australia, and not just for their culture. It's a shop window of how people think here and how they do business and their engineering and how avant-garde they are in all sorts of, you know, in technology and whatever. So you have to convince the people of your own country that you are essential to the promotion of that, and that you're a good investment. You know, you are a very good investment. And I'm constantly trying to convince people back home, you know, we're not just you know, traveling around and having fun. You know, we're actually representing the social values of Canada. We're representing what we know, our technological knowledge, our scientific knowledge, our literacy. We're representing stuff that people need to know about you if they want to invest in your country, if they want to exchange with your country, if they want to do deals.
Now, obviously, you're a good investment, given the quality and the success of your work. But not everything you make has been successful. I've read, there's a book I was reading. I'm a critic, I'm
Do
allowed
we really
to
have
say
to
this.
Go into the...
The book, The Theatricality of Robert Lepage, a writer says that your only real failure as a solo performer was the work Elsinore, because you could never establish an alter ego to personalise the material. Other works like The Seven Streams of the River Otter were savaged when they first opened, and have gone on to rave reviews when they've been finessed over time. So I wanted to ask, how important is it to you to take risks and to sometimes fail and then to rebuild?
Yeah. But it's important, and I think that that's what the thing is, that you have to persevere. And of course, if you're in a system where opening night is a guillotine, of course, there's no chance that, you know, so you either hit it off or you don't, right? But the way we work is that opening night is just yet another rehearsal, but with audience. And then the audiences continue to come, and the audience and the critics and whoever writes or talks about the show or give comments collaborate to the show, whether it's good criticism or not. And you know, you inject that into your work, and you continue editing it, and you continue making it new and making it what it is the day that it is. And we've always been doing that. So that's why the example you're giving of Seven Streams, we had this horrible opening night in Edinburgh Festival, where people were expecting Don Giovanni. No, but they were literally, it was programmed, the opening of the festival was supposed to be Don Giovanni, and that event got cancelled about a week before, and they said, well, we have Robert Lepage in this kind of odd venue with a work in progress of something that will be 7 hours, but it's only 3 hours. And people came in with their opera, their gala wear, and all of that, and their medals. And they're sitting there, and of course it's a half-baked idea, it's a festival show, you know, and of course we were panned out of this world. And most London critics that had traveled to see the show said, you know, they would all say, it's over. I'll always remember, they would say, well, it's over. The Lepage years are over, it's over. What Lepage years? What's over? You know, come on. So anyway, so we were like decapitated, and said, okay, well then so be it. You know, there's other countries than the British Isles and all that. So and a year later we're performing in London, and we have the full thing, and it's the year 2000, and the critics circle, the same who came and killed the show and said it was over, all voted for the 10 most important shows of the 20th century, and we were number 7. So you know, so that's what I'm saying, is that you have to persevere. And the thing is also, because if your audience is elsewhere, which is also, I think, an advantage when you're a touring company, there are shows that people from the South prefer and people from the North don't understand or don't like. And that's what it is. You cannot generalize all the time and say, the audience. There are audiences that have different sensibilities, who are preoccupied by other things. 887 resonates in a very different way in Australia than it did in France, that it did in Scotland when we did it, or in Spain. It's a different show. But there's a core to it that's, you know, I think universal, and there's things that move people in the same way. But people don't laugh in the same places, and they don't listen with the same ears, and you have to accept that. That's part of the complex world in which we live, and it's, I think it's fascinating. It's interesting.
Speaking of the audience, I think we might throw to some questions from the audience now, and then we'll do a bit of back and forth, questions from me and questions from the audience, because I know there's a lot of people in the audience who've seen, probably, I imagine, a great deal of your work and have some specific questions to ask. Just a reminder, to paraphrase Neil Gaiman's definition of a question, it's a short few words ending in a question mark designed to be answered from the stage.
Robert, thanks for the fantastic show. I really loved it. Now, what were the first three bits, say, that you created for 887?
What were the first, what? The first three bits?
Three bits, the first segments. Which did the, I kind of think maybe the cab scene came first. What came first in terms of the order for you, in terms of the creation, uh-huh. How did the creation develop in terms of the bits that make up the whole?
Okay, well, at first, I mean, now it's falsely a show about memory. It became about memory with time, but that's how I describe it. It's a project about memory, but it wasn't really. At start, I was just fascinated with this starting point, which was the building where I was brought up between 1960 and 1970. So I was obsessed by trying to reproduce a model of that building in the rehearsal room, knowing that it would be very expensive to do that. So we took cardboard and we punched holes in the car, and we tried to. And the whole process of remodeling that and playing around with it and having Barbie dolls and doing all these things, of course, puts you in a childlike state where you go back to, you know, when you were a kid and playing around and playing city. I remember when I was a kid, I liked city. I'd like to build cities, you know, whatever. And so suddenly I was dealing with small cars and all that. So that pretty much was the beginning of the whole thing of trying to remember who were in these different apartments and in these windows and who were they and what were they about. And then trying to figure out, well, are they interesting enough to be in the show? Because what do they carry with them as stories? And how do they relate to a more general theme that started to appear, which was the social and political context of Quebec in the 1960s, which was quite explosive. So that's pretty much the... So it was a bit like a garage band thing. You know, we were in a small room playing with scissors and masking tape and doing this thing. And then you start playing around and eventually the scene comes up, you know, just describing who's where and what do they do. And then after that, you start playing with that box and opening it up and saying, well, should we see another side of the building? And that creates another scene and so. So I have to admit, there's probably somewhere videos and recordings of in what order things happened, but I can't remember really. But it's certainly the first game that we played was to try to find a scale for building that building in the rehearsal room.
Robert, you mentioned taking risks. What risks did you and the Met Opera take in your involvement in The Ring?
Well, it was a big financial risk. No, it wasn't at the start. It's just that for me, what I found strange about the Ring is that it had been mounted so many times in Europe, and there had only been a few production of it in North America. So actually, even if the opera aficionados or the Wagnerites know The Ring very well, they haven't seen much productions of them, and even in New York. So I wanted to go back to the original idea of it, which is an Icelandic mythological thing that Wagner kind of made German. But before that, it was an Icelandic thing. So it was much more about tectonic plates and movements and what Iceland is about, because it is a country that is actually moving and separating and cracking. So all of the mythology comes out of that, of these eruptions, and so the very, very natural phenomena that are incarnated into gods and all that. So for me, that was a big risk, because everybody was expecting the 17th reinterpretation of the concentration camps of Dachau, and, you know, what people usually do with the ring. And I wanted to strip it bare to something very, very basic and natural, and make it a geology thing. But of course, I had to be confronted to the New York Wagnerites and tons of people in the room who would show up with the score on their I've seen on their lap, and they're not watching the production. They're just going, like this. Go. Oh, they've shortened this. They've cut a few bars here. They're not supposed to cut those bars. And they did, and then suddenly your set cracks a bit. You know, just, and they go. It's not supposed to exist, you know. So anyway, so that was my biggest challenge turned out to be to deal with the Wagnerites in New York. But
I wanted to ask a question about physicality for a moment. Mm-hmm. I believe you're making your own theatre in Quebec City, the Diamond.
Yeah.
Which I've read is something to do with tunnels in a cliff.
Yeah, but that's the old project. It's not that anymore.
Oh, okay.
that one was about 200 million something, and we said, forget about it. So now we have a much more... But it's next door to the tunnel.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But I guess what I wanted to know is, why create your own physical theatre space as opposed to staging work around the world? And what will be unique or Lepagian about your own theatre?
No, I mean, the room that we need to actually... Because we don't perform that much in Quebec City. We perform in Montreal a bit more and around the world, but we don't get to perform in our own town because there's just no venue that is made in the shape of the shows that we do. There are some, and we have to patch up sometimes. So we want to perform more in our hometown. We want to have basically a place where we could play and rep all the different shows. I don't know how many shows are touring right now. There's four or five of our productions performing, either an opera is performing in New York, and then we have a Needles and Opiums touring somewhere in France. And so we have many stuff touring at the same time, and we'd like to do a little less touring, do more residential stuff, and to kind of revisit the things and polish them and refurbish them and rewrite them also, because nothing's really written, even though sometimes we've been touring for 10 years, but things are still need to be written. So it's that kind of space that we need, and we need to because we're kind of spreading the company thin right now. There's, you know, so many teams all around, and we need to gather the company a bit more. But it will still be touring, but maybe not as much.
Mm-hmm. More questions from the floor.
What have you found are the hardest things of doing a one-man show?
The thing is that you're really on your own. I mean, it sounds like an obvious thing, but, you know, to be alone on stage is it's a tough thing. And it's the thing that it exposes first is your loneliness, right? Because a solo show is always necessarily about a lonely person or somebody who feels that he's alone, whether confronting a conflict or whatever. So there is this kind of thing. And I'm extremely lucky because most of my life I've spent it, in a good love relationships and friendships and a working environment that's filled with tons of creative people and all that. So I'm not a lonely person, but I was a very lonely person when I was very young. I was very isolated. So when I walk on stage, I kind of go back to that place, which is kind of an odd thing. But it's part of who I am. So for me, that's the vertigo. A solo show is necessarily exposing your solitude, your that you, however you try to relate, there's a part of you that feels alone. And you can only tell that story if you're alone on stage. So I don't know if that answers the question.
Thinking of your comments before about working with actors and theatre, is this the same with your involvement in your many operas? Mm-hmm.
It's different because, of course, things are not just written in an opera. Things are scored. You know, you come in and there's a score, and time is decided by somebody else. The maestro is the chief. He's responsible of time, and you're responsible of space, basically. So your relationship with the singer is very strange, because the singer is listening to two directors, somebody that will guide he or her time-wise, not just the tempo, the inner time, sometimes even the psychological motivations are part of this idea of time, how you sing and why you sing and why is it this pitch and why is it this tessature. It's because of an inner time thing. And that person listens to that and also then listens to you, and you're responsible of that person's body. Everything has to do with space, movement, the strong positions in space, the set, all of that aspect, and also how you could support the person's voice. You know, the person, opera is about voice. It's the first thing, and you have to. Your job is to support that. How do you make the voice clear and loud and heard? So that's also part of the spatial relationship with the singer. But you have to have the humility that you are not the boss. There are two bosses. And they have equal say, and you have to get along with that other boss. And you hope that he won't infringe too much on your part of the responsibility, and that you try not to infringe too much on his vision of what time is.
More questions?
I don't know whether you've given this performance in French, but if you were suddenly asked to do that right here, how much would it change, and in what ways would it change? Mm-hmm.
Well, it'd be very different because, anyways, the performance that we're giving right now is about language. It's about you know, the fact that French Canadians lived for a long time under a very different. In a very different reality than English Canada, and there was all sorts of cohabitation problems because of the cultural and the language gap, or the language clash. So the show kind of exposes that. But when I do the whole show in French, that's a general theme. But when I do it in English, parts of it are still in French. So there's a friction between the two languages, which is, I think, even more interesting. I think the show is more interesting in English than it is in French. But it's a longer show in French, because French is a language that just goes on forever. and also because I'm a very different person. Like right now, I'm a different person in English. I'm not the same person in French, and anybody who's bilingual or trilingual will tell you that. You know that. It's radically different, and it comes with the language. It comes with the energy, or it comes with what you think the language is about, right? So I'm much funkier and all that in English, and in French I'm much more intellectual, or maybe I don't know. It's difficult to say because it's my mother tongue, but so and I think that I'm very interested in language, and most of my shows involve actors from all parts, every part of the world. Some of them don't even speak French or English. Some of them are Spanish or German, and they show up, and we improv, and we find a way to integrate our characters, and find a way to have all these linguistic realities expressed and incarnated on stage. And it's interesting because, you know, an actress I won't name, who was the daughter of a bishop really English, very cold persona. And but when she spoke French, she was the funniest person on earth. Suddenly she had a sense of humor. And when she spoke Spanish, she was this, you know, let my hair down kind of. Yeah, and it was amazing. It was so she would play different characters, and we just knew that it would be better for her to do it in this language or that language, because she had three radically different personalities, and she had a good command of the three languages. So,
a question from a friend, Jim Lawson, who's also a theatre maker: how do we explore memory and the personal without getting too self-indulgent? Where are the lines, if any?
Well, that's the thing, is that in this show about memory that I'm doing, there's a lot of personal memory, but I only select the memories that will find an echo in a more general sense of memory, which is the social and political context of Quebec in the 1960s and 70s. So when I feel it resounds, or that it's a small example of a reality that is bigger, I select that. So it's not, the show is not just about me. Suddenly, it's about a collective, a group of people. If it's just about me, it's of no interest, I think. It's interesting for me if I want to do a therapy, but it's not interesting for the audience, I think. What's interesting when you work with the theme of memory, there's many layers of that. And for an actor, I mean, one of the reasons why I decided to do this, about this theme, is because as an aging actor, you're preoccupied. I had a blank for the first time in this show last night, and you witnessed that. I had a huge blank. And I couldn't remember the name of the Liberal Prime Minister of Canada in the 1965, and it was Pearson or something like that. Anyways, I couldn't remember his first name, and I just kind of... But anyways, you're afraid of these moments and of these things as you. So the thing is that when you're a kid, the first time you act in a school play, the very first compliment is always, "My God, what a memory you have," as if theater is about remembering, you know, more than expressing. So that always intrigued me. I said, "Well, you know, it's a sport. It's a sport of memory, you know." And when I was asked by the in Barcelona, I was asked by the Catalonian National Theater to do The Tempest. And they said, Robert, if you're interested to come to Barcelona to do The Tempest, now we have the Catalonian actors who are old enough to play characters like King Lear or Prospero. And I said, so what do you mean now they're old enough? They weren't old enough before that. And he said to me, no, he said, because we lost a generation of actors because when Franco came in during the Civil War, forbade the Catalonian language, burned books, burned plays, burned poetry and all that, and said, well, the only memory left of these things are in the minds of the actors and the people who recite these poems, or the actors who have played these plays. So they were either killed or they had to be exiled. So then you see the responsibility you have as an actor to remember, you know. So for me, that was a very, very, very concrete example of what actors are for. We're there to remember. That's part of the sport that we practice.
Time for another question or two from the audience.
Thank you. Hi, Robert. In the 1970s, when I started to first meet theatre practitioners and people I really respected, they told me theatre is over, it's dead, it can go as far as it can go. Mm-hmm. And then a few years ago, I heard David Mamet being asked the same question: is theatre dying? And he said, oh, it's always dying. So Mike, I have to ask you, is theatre dying? And is it always going to be dying?
Well, I'll answer, I'll quote Frank Zappa. Theater is not dead, it just smells funny. What I think is that theater is not dead, it's just that the incarnation or the way, the manifestations of theater, the way we know it classically, are probably kind of fading away, and they're probably less popular. But as I was saying earlier, the only way theatre can survive if it is eventful, if it's an event. People nowadays can sit in their in front of their home videos. They have these amazing home cinemas, high definition, and they go on Netflix and they could download for very cheaply these masterpieces, and they could have stories told, and now more and more with 3D and all of that. They don't need you. They don't need theater. They need it if it's essential, if it's an event. But they won't drive out into town, park the car, pay for a parking lot, pay for a babysitter. All of that is cumbersome. So how do you attract people to the theater? You could only attract them if it's an event and if they need it. So it makes it tougher, but I think that people will always need they will always need the ceremony of theater, because it's not the same experience as when you go to see a movie, however entertaining and mind-boggling it could be sometimes, because you're useful. In the audience, any audience member is useful to the play. They're not useful to the film. A film is light dancing on a screen. It's pre-recorded, and it will not change. It doesn't need you to exist. It needs your money, but it doesn't need your presence. Even if the whole room laughs or claps or hates it or boos, they will continue doing what they're doing, unmoved. But in the theater, it changes everything. Absolutely everything. If the room is half full, if people are screaming at you, if people are laughing, if people don't get it, if people, whatever the reaction, it changes everything. So people in the room are useful. They play a part in that event, right? So, and people need that and they want that. So that, I think, will always exist. And that's why I say theater will always exist. It just won't probably have the shape and form that we're used to. It just has to evolve and to find its way in the new decorums that we will find for it.
We have time for one last question.
Hi, I'm leading on from that, the theory of these events, and I was just wondering if you think that, and what I've been noticing in theatre is like these events have more been coming from immersive or interactive performances. And I'm wondering, like, what your thoughts on those sort of performances rather than, like, this fourth wall sort of performances are. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm open to every form and every... I mean, there's a big trend right now in New York. You know, they do this Sleep No More experiences and all these things. And, you know, it is theater. It has another form. It has another... And interaction is good. I don't have any kind of taste, a specific... taste in certain theater more than another theater. I'm open to any kind of form of theater, as long as it's about storytelling, and as long as it that the audience feels intelligent and feels respected, and that there's a real dialogue between the audience and what goes on stage. You know, there's a very important thing. When people read Hamlet and they stage Hamlet, they cut it down because it's way too long. And because it has to fit into an evening, right, between the last train and the 7 o'clock pub or whatever. And some of them even try to do it without an interval and all that. But when you read it carefully, you need the whole 5 hours. And there's so many intervals. And the intervals are there. They're part of the play. The intervals are there for people to say, well, I don't know, who's this Gertrude? You know, and somebody says, that's the mother. Oh, I wasn't sure. You need, that's how the play is written. It's written so that there's a stop and people go to have a drink and they interact together and they relate what they're seeing to some local thing going on or whatever. And then they explain the play to each other and then they come back informed with that and they continue. So the interval is as important as the writing and as the story that's being told. That's what theater is. Theater is not just a great play. It's an event. It's the interaction between people with the stage, but people amongst each other. So just to give you an example, when we did that 9-hour show, we came to Melbourne, actually, with Lip Sync. And, of course, everybody says, well, I'm going to encourage you. I'm going to come for the first 3 or 4 hours. And then after that. And, of course, they all stayed, and they all wanted another hour or two. But the thing is that when you're going to sit in a room for a 9-hour show, you're conscious you're going to be part of a marathon, right? And you sit there. So the people sitting next to you, they're co-marathoners. Is that an English word? Maratonians? Whatever. They're not just the guy sitting next to me. They're just kind of... And you don't sit on your seat the same way if you're going to be there for 9 hours. And there's intervals. And suddenly you're a community. After the second interval, people are a community. And you know the people who are there. And you know the actors. And you recognize them because it's 9 hours. So they've been, you know, changing costumes and changing. And at the end of the evening, this is... community that's been created. You don't get that in 2 hours. You don't get that in 3 hours. You get that when you start extending it and you make it an event. And eventually, and people say, okay, we're going in for another hour, and they go and you've eaten, and you've... There's this whole Boy Scout thing, you know, where we're going to camp here today. So how is it going to be? You know, and okay, how do we deal with our natural functions in a context like this? When do we eat? And how long is the pause? And who's there? Do you want to change place with me? Because the lady in front of us won't take her hat off. Okay, well, you're smart. So all these amazing things happen in a 6, 7, 8, or 9 hour context that don't happen in 2 hours. But it's a collectivity. It's a community that suddenly appears, and we need to have a sense of community.
Ladies and gentlemen, please thank Robert Lepage.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Center podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercenter.com for the best in books, writing, and ideas from Melbourne, Australia, and the world.